Chapter 3. The Arms Deal Goes to Braamfontein. It was Paul Ricoeur who said, "The servile will is the will that makes itself a slave to authority. It diminishes human nature." Preparing the case for the Constitutional Court involved a complete tactical revision. Before dealing with this aspect, it will be useful to recount what the court is meant to do and how it goes about its business. The following summary is drawn largely from the court's own website, as at 2016. The Constitutional Court deals exclusively with final appeals and constitutional matters, those cases that raise questions about the application or interpretation of the Constitution. A case can reach it in one of four ways: as the result of an appeal against a judgment of the High Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal, by way of a direct application, asking it to sit as a court of first and last instance because of the urgency of the matter, when a lower court declares a piece of legislation invalid, which requires confirmation by the Constitutional Court, or when the President asks it to review a bill. The court has the discretion to decide whether or not it will hear a matter, except when an act has already been declared invalid and the court is required to confirm the finding. Typically, cases that reach the Constitutional Court start in the High Court, which has the power to grant various remedies and can declare legislation invalid. Any decision that invalidates provincial or parliamentary legislation or any conduct of the President must be confirmed by the Constitutional Court before it has any effect. If the High Court rules against an application, the Constitutional Court may be approached on appeal. Applicants must show that the case concerns a constitutional matter. The Constitutional Court judges will decide if an important principle relating to the interpretation of the Constitution has been raised, and consider whether there is a reasonable prospect that the appeal may succeed. If the court decides to grant leave to appeal, or wishes to hear argument about whether leave to appeal should be granted, the case is set down for a certain date so that argument from the parties can be heard. Each party submits written submissions before the date of argument so that the judges can familiarize themselves with the case and the position taken by each party. Sometimes other interested parties may ask to be joined in proceedings or to be admitted as an amicus curiae, which means a friend of the court. They too will make written submissions and sometimes give oral argument, if directed by the Chief Justice to do so. As regards direct access, the Constitution allows a person, when it is in the interests of justice and with the leave of the Constitutional Court, to bring a matter directly to the Constitutional Court or to appeal directly to the Constitutional Court from any other court. This is only allowed in exceptional circumstances. Matters are heard by a quorum of at least 8 judges. Usually, all 11 judges hear every case. The court does not hear evidence or question witnesses. As it functions largely as a court of appeal, it considers the evidence heard in the original court that heard the matter. As a result, the court works largely with written arguments presented to it. The hearings are intended to address difficult issues raised by those arguments. Once a case has been set down, the Chief Justice will ask a particular judge to prepare for it and possibly write the judgment. Usually, cases will be spread out so that each judge writes a judgment from time to time. Once all parties have been heard, the judges meet to discuss the possible outcome of the case. Writing a judgment is a long process. The assigned judge prepares a first draft and circulates it. The judges then meet and submit comments on, or changes to, the draft. If a dissenting judgment has been written, the judges will begin to indicate which judgment they will follow and why. Sometimes lengthy discussion takes place. Once consensus is reached, the judgments are thoroughly checked. The judgment is then handed down or released at a public sitting of the court. Applications for direct access to the Constitutional Court take the form of a notice of motion supported by an affidavit which sets out the facts which the applicant relies on for relief. The applications are lodged with the registrar and served on all parties with a direct or substantial interest in the relief claimed. The applications set out why the applicant believes granting the order to direct access is in the interest of justice, the nature of the relief sought, and the grounds upon which such relief is based. Whether the matter can be dealt with by the court without hearing oral evidence, and if it can't, how such evidence should be adduced and conflicts of fact resolved. Parties wishing to oppose the application are required to notify the applicant and the registrar of their intention to do so. The Chief Justice may then call on the respondents to make written submissions to the court about whether or not direct access should be granted, or indicate that no written submissions or affidavits need be filed. Given all this, Terry not only had to motivate why the court should grant his plea, but why it should consider the matter at all. Specifically, the particulars of claim had to be refashioned into an affidavit submitted by Terry asking the court to order the current president to appoint a commission of inquiry or to reconsider the decision of his predecessor, Galema Motlanthe, not to do so, and explaining why he believed the court should hear the matter. It was October 2010, a long haul and many moons after the initial spark of inspiration in the People's Cathedral, almost 2 years earlier. Terry's legal team decided that a lean and mean approach was still indicated. The particulars of claim were attached to the affidavit, together with the timeline of the activities around the arms deals drawn from Paul Holden's book, The Arms Deal in Your Pocket. In the affidavit, Terry stated that the president had thwarted his attempt to litigate the matter in the High Court, but that he was prepared to return there if ordered to do so. Preparing the matter for trial to the point at which the plaintiff could issue a subpoena compelling the ANC to produce its financial records and the report of its internal inquiry into the arms deals was one of Terry's primary goals. This was the one thing the presidential legal team wanted to avoid above all else. It may be that the president decided to avoid the High Court hearing in the hope that Terry could not afford a constitutional court hearing and would be put off by the effort involved. In subsequent cases, the president adopted topsy-turvy stances in relation to jurisdiction. When Fred Daniel, who dreams of creating a transfrontier national park near Badplaas in Mpumalanga, went directly to the constitutional court to ask for a commission of inquiry into corruption in that province, he was told to start in the High Court. When, in August 2012, the Marikana widows went to the High Court in an attempt to compel the president to release the Farlam Commission report he had received in March, the president argued that the High Court did not have jurisdiction. Such are the gyrations of political expediency. In Terry's case, the notice of application and founding affidavit were duly filed in the Constitutional Court soon after the President had argued that the High Court did not have the power to entertain Terry's claims. Stripped of excess verbiage and procedural waffle, Terry's affidavit stated the following. He had instituted the High Court action after the current President's predecessor had refused the request for the appointment of a commission of inquiry by Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu and former President F.W. de Klerk. The pleadings in this action were not yet closed. The President had filed exceptions that required amendments to the original claim. Following these amendments, the President filed a further exception, arguing that the matter should be heard in the Constitutional Court. Even if this was incorrect, Terry argued, the interests of justice would be served by gaining direct access to the Constitutional Court. Reasons included, Continued litigation about the exceptions would create long delays in getting to grips with the real issues. This would not serve the public interest or the interests of justice. Adherence to the rule of law was a foundational value of South Africa's constitutional democracy and required functionaries of state, including the president, to discharge their constitutional obligations and responsibilities in a fair and accountable manner. The factual matrix underpinning his case, as set out in the amended particulars of claim, was replete with evidence and allegations that cried out for proper investigation, with a view to bringing anyone guilty of criminal activity to justice. Even if some or all of the allegations were ill-founded, the mere fact that they existed justified the appointment of a commission of inquiry. If any wrongdoing was uncovered, the relevant arms deals could be cancelled and the South African government could claim damages in terms of escape clauses in the relevant contracts. In any case, under the common law, the government could withdraw from the deals in question and claim restitution. This would save billions of rands in public funds, which could be put to better use than buying unnecessary and unsuitable arms. The scourge of corruption needed to be addressed if South Africa's constitutional democracy was to survive. The president, the government, and the ANC had repeatedly declared that addressing corruption was one of the country's top priorities. In reality, public resources, time, and energy had been massively squandered on attempted cover-ups of the arms deal scandal. Unless and until a proper, independent, and thorough investigation is undertaken, Terry declared, the allegations of irregularities, fraud, and corruption will remain unaddressed to the detriment of the people of South Africa and those against whom the allegations are directed. The credibility of leading politicians and the viability of constitutional democracy and good governance are also threatened by the failure to appoint a commission of inquiry. He also noted the following. On 4th October 2010, Colonel Johan du Plois, the only member of the Hawks still working on the arms deal investigations, informed him that the head of the Hawks, Major General Anwar Dramat, had closed the police investigation into the BAE and German frigate consortium arms deals 4 days previously. This was a perplexing decision, as Saab had been charged in the Swedish courts with corruption arising out of its role in the BAE arms deal. Until the demise of the Scorpions, the British Serious Fraud Office, or SFO as it is known, and the South African National Prosecuting Authority had collaborated closely with one another to the point where, in November 2008, the Pretoria High Court granted an order allowing the Scorpions to search premises in Cape Town and Gauteng owned by or linked to Fana Shlongwane, former advisor to the late Defence Minister Joe Madisi and the Zimbabwean arms trader, businessman John Breedenkamp. This followed long-running Serious Fraud Office investigations into the British aerospace deal, which had uncovered large payments to Shlongwane and Breedenkamp while they were in a position to influence the award of the 21 billion rand contract. On 7th September 2010, Hawks representatives told the Standing Committee on Public Accounts in Parliament that the Scorpions had handed over 460 boxes and 4.7 million computer pages of evidence against British aerospace. The seizure of documents in November 2008 was public knowledge. This had preceded and motivated the joint appeal by Archbishop Tutu and former President de Klerk to the former president for a judicial commission of inquiry. Documents in Terry's possession included 166 pages of affidavits by Scorpion and Serious Fraud Office officials detailing how British Aerospace had paid bribes totaling £115 million to secure its contracts, to whom the bribes were paid and into which bank accounts. If necessary, these papers would be made available to the Constitutional Court. On 8 February 2010, he had written to the President, urging him to deal with the irregularities in the arms deals or appoint a commission of inquiry. The President did not respond. On the 6th of August 2010, he had written a detailed letter to SCOPA, asking it to request the President to appoint a judicial commission of inquiry into British Aerospace's payment of bribes in order to secure its contracts with South Africa. Given the remedies in case of bribes clause in the BAE contracts, the Commission should consider whether Arms Corps and or the government should cancel the contracts and claim compensation. Terry had attended a SCOPA meeting on this issue on the 7th of September 2010. The disinterested and defensive attitude of the majority of its members confirmed that there was no political will either in Parliament or in the Hawks to investigate the arms deal. Indeed, SCOPA's attitude and the decision by the Hawks to close its investigations made a mockery of any stated intentions by those in power to address allegations of corruption. I have also brought this matter to the attention of the public protector, Terry wrote, but have received no response. I therefore affirm that all other fora have been investigated and exhausted. Much water had flowed under the bridge since the arms deals were concluded. Many of the potential witnesses were no longer young or well. Shabir Sheikh, for example, was on medical parole due to a medical finding that he was terminally ill. There's also much documentation, some of which was in jeopardy of being lost or destroyed, which any conscientious commission of inquiry would want to consider. It was therefore appropriate to afford the matter a degree of priority in the public interest. Dramat's decision to close the police investigations might lead to the precipitate and unfortunate destruction of documents in the possession of the police, which were vital to getting to the truth of the allegations in the amended particulars of claim. Terry's Cape Town attorney had written to Dramat to request that all documentation in the possession of the police be preserved pending the final determination of this matter. No response had been received. Given the evidence as set out in detail in the amended particulars of claim, Terry wrote, it was illegal and irrational for the President to have failed or refused to appoint a commission of inquiry and asked the court to instruct the President to do so. He also asked the court to enable the hearing of evidence in Europe from relevant arms suppliers, politicians, and those involved in the investigation and prosecution then in progress in Europe. A breathless wait for directions from the court followed the filing of the application. We did not have to wait long. On the 30th of November 2010, the court ordered the President and government to file affidavits responding to the application for direct access by Tuesday, 7th December 2010. Terry now had a toehold on being heard. The court had not rebuffed him without a hearing, as happens often and happened to Fred Daniel when he sought the same kind of relief as Terry from the Constitutional Court. In the event, the affidavits filed in response to the court's directions were disappointing. The President made no effort to deal with the substance of the application. Instead, as in the High Court, he presented a range of technical arguments, even going so far as to suggest that the High Court was the appropriate venue for the case. This was really rich, coming from the same legal team that had argued earlier that the High Court had no right or jurisdiction to hear the matter. On 7th February 2011, the Constitutional Court set the matter down for hearing on the 5th of May 2011 and asked for written and oral arguments in response to the following questions. Under what circumstances Is the Constitutional Court empowered to scrutinise the exercise by the President of his constitutional power to appoint a commission of inquiry? Does the Constitution oblige the President to exercise this power whenever there are indications of corruption, malfeasance and misfeasance in relation to public procurement? If not, in what circumstances do indications of corruption, malfeasance and misfeasance oblige the President to appoint a commission of inquiry? More particularly, in the circumstances alleged by the applicant, and assuming that all his allegations are true, does it follow that the President is constitutionally obliged to exercise his power to appoint a commission of inquiry? If so, what steps should the court take to resolve disputes of fact? If not, is the court able to dispose of the application without resolving disputes of fact? Peter Hazel and I thought long and hard about these questions. The success or failure of the case would depend on how we answered them. We eventually decided we should say that a president who irrationally refused to appoint a commission when asked on sound grounds to do so should be subjected to the scrutiny of the courts for conduct inconsistent with the Constitution. This argument is based on the supremacy of the rule of law and the Constitution, and the invalidity of conduct that infringes the doctrine of legality, which requires rationality in decision-making, in that decisions taken should serve a legitimate purpose of government. Any refusal to appoint a commission of inquiry into an issue that cried out for investigation would, we thought, fit the criteria for being struck down as invalid by the courts. This argument does not mean that any such situation would necessitate a commission. A complaint to the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, or even the police may suffice in a situation in which the facts are known or not concealed and a clear-cut case can be made. If, however, as was apparent in respect of the arms deals, malfeasance and misfeasance are covered up, a commission is indicated. Whether or not a commission should be appointed would depend on the rationality of the refusal to appoint. We were back at the point Susanna Cowan had raised in St. George's Cathedral after Paul Holden's address more than 2 years previously. Lastly, we argued that it was not necessary to resolve disputes of fact. Their existence was enough to justify the appointment of a commission of inquiry. Alternatively, they could be resolved by a commissioner or referred back to the Western Cape High Court. The President, not unexpectedly, had a very different take on the matter, which emerged from the rather sparse heads of argument filed on his behalf. In essence, they argued that the President was not obliged to appoint a commission of inquiry whenever there were indications of corruption, malfeasance and misfeasance in relation to public procurement, and could assign the task of dealing with such allegations to other state agencies, which he had done in respect of the arms deals. These measures could only be challenged if they were irrational or otherwise inconsistent with the Constitution, which was not the case in this instance. This would still be the case even if the applicant could prove all his allegations. As a result, issues around resolving disputes of fact did not arise. In our heads of argument, we dealt with the questions at far greater length. We submitted we had to show that the President's refusal to appoint a commission of inquiry was irrational, but could in fact do so. Grounds for stating this included the following. No official investigation of the arms deal was currently in progress. In the light of the convictions of Yengeni and Sheikh, the investigation of Zuma and the criminal investigations in Europe of the same arms deals and dealers, it was clear that the rule of law would be negatively impacted if these allegations of corruption were true. The Scorpions, the last state institution to seriously investigate the arms deal, were disbanded in July 2009. The last person with the authority and personal independence to drive such an inquiry was the National Director of Public Prosecutions, Vusi Bikoli, who was suspended in September 2007 and eventually dismissed without good reason. None of his successors had displayed his appetite to act without fear, favour, or prejudice in investigating the arms deals. The Scorpion's successor, the Hawks, had closed its files, yet it was the only unit which could theoretically investigate criminality in respect of the arms deals. As the inquiry involved both criminal and civil law, the Independent Commission of Inquiry was the only rational means of investigating both aspects. The public protector had not responded to an approach by the applicant dated the 30th of August 2010. The Standing Committee on Public Accounts in Parliament had been thwarted by the Hawke's decision to close its file and by the general unwillingness of the National Director of Public Prosecutions to investigate the matter. There had been no response to the applicant's letter to the chairman of SCOPA, dated the 6th of August 2010. The fact that the post-Polokwane ANC leadership had held an internal inquiry into the arms deals but had not made the findings public was significant. In that, a clean bill of health would surely have been publicised. In these circumstances, we wrote, the inference is inescapable that there is no political will, accountably and openly, to get to grips with the allegations of impropriety surrounding the arms deals. By compelling an inquiry, the court will immeasurably enhance the public confidence it already enjoys and will bolster its legitimacy as the main bulwark against the abuse of power by serving the law and the Constitution as a check on the incorrect and improper exercise of procedural executive power, which is inherent in the refusals to appoint a commission of inquiry in circumstances which cry out for an appointment to be made. The circumstances sketched in the papers filed and referred to earlier created a factual matrix that made it patently irrational to fail or refuse to appoint a commission of inquiry. The failure of the Criminal Justice Administration, the Office of the Public Protector, and the Standing Committee on Public Accounts to get to grips with the serious allegations of corruption, malfeasance, and misfeasance, which were first aired in Parliament as long ago as the 9th of September 1999, is reason enough to oblige the President, acting in terms of the rule of law and the precepts of legality, rationality, and fairness, to appoint a commission of inquiry. Given the unusual, perhaps unique, circumstances of the case, an independent commission of inquiry was the only rational means of investigating the criminal as well as civil ramifications of the allegations of corruption, malfeasance, and misfeasance in the course of the arms procurement process. It would be irrational and therefore unconstitutional for the President to persist in the failure and refusal to appoint a commission of inquiry in the face of the mountain of evidence contained in the founding papers filed by him, read with the three books, court records, judgments, and records of investigation to which he refers as part of the allegations of fact. We argued that the questions surrounding possible factual disputes could not be addressed before it became clear whether the President would dispute any of the facts and allegations, which he had not yet done. Accordingly, we asked the court to order the President to file an affidavit responding to the substance of the applicant's claims. We waited, hoping that the President, unlikely, or the court, perhaps, would respond to the informal invitation for the President to deal with the substance of Terry's affidavit. When there was no movement on the issue, we launched a formal application, which the President opposed and the court did not deal with prior to the scheduled date for hearing of the 5th of May 2011. The table was accordingly decked for a battle royal. In the run-up to the hearing, we received comfort and succour from a welcome ally, the South African Institute of Race Relations, whose then-director, John Kane Berman, had long advocated the appointment of a commission of inquiry into the arms deals, decided to intervene as an amicus curiae, or friend of the court, Professor Max Duplessis led the legal team assembled for the intervention, and my old Wits University classmate, Anthea Jeffrey, head of research at the Institute of Race Relations, submitted a supporting affidavit. Two sections of the heads of argument of the amicus are noteworthy. The first discussed the effects of corruption, and the second responded to the questions posed by the Chief Justice in his practice note. On the threat of corruption to the constitutional order, the heads of argument stated that both the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal had emphasized that corruption threatened the rule of law, good governance, democracy, and fundamental rights. International conventions also recognized that corruption undermines accountability, transparency, and government's ability to provide basic services. South Africa's own legislation, in the form of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, acknowledged that corruption undermines rights, the credibility of governments, democracy, morality, and the rule of law. In the recent Glenister case, both the majority and the minority judgments of the Constitutional Court had identified corruption as a scourge which posed a grave danger to democracy, accountability, the rule of law, and guaranteed human rights. Among other things, the court held that endemic corruption threatened the injunction that government must be accountable, responsive, and open, that public administration must not only be held to account, but must also be governed by high standards of ethics and efficiency, and must use public resources in an economic and effective way. As regards public finance, the Constitution demanded budgetary and expenditure processes marked by openness, accountability, and effective financial management. Similar requirements applied to public procurement when organs of state contracted for goods and services. In the Glenister case, the Constitutional Court had definitively recognized the effects of corruption on the life of a nation, its laws and the rights of all its people, its ability to decimate hard-earned freedoms and its insidious nature, and held that the state has a duty to root it out. The amicus submits that Glenister is an essential prism through which to view the present matter. The arms deal and the corruption associated with it from the outset, some alleged, some already proven in court, has become a central and debilitating feature of our political life. The public, the government, and those implicated by allegations of impropriety deserve for the truth to be uncovered. The respondent's obligation to seek the truth about alleged corrupt activities was ultimately sourced in the Constitution and the state's constitutional duty to fight corruption. In the Glenister case, both the minority and majority judgments emphasized that the Constitution required effective action against corruption, and both judgments emphasized the duty to establish effective mechanisms to combat corruption. Section 7(2) of the Constitution required the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. Given that corruption infringed on the rights in the Bill of Rights, this section required the state to prevent and combat corruption in all its forms. In particular, it required a comprehensive response to corruption, which included efficient anti-corruption mechanisms. If the government's constitutional duty, post-Glenister, is to create efficient anti-corruption mechanisms, the Institute for Race Relations heads of argument concluded, then that duty must similarly inform government's conduct in response to a serious request for a commission of inquiry to be appointed in the arms deal. Where the other mechanisms, the parallel processes which the president invoked in his refusal, are found not to be efficient or effective or sufficiently independent, as intended by the court in Glenister, then it cannot be a reasonable exercise of the government's duty to refuse such a request. The heads of argument also responded to the Chief Justice's questions in some detail. First, the Institute for Race Relations argued that given that the President derived all his powers, including the power to appoint commissions of inquiry, from the Constitution, the Constitutional Court was empowered to scrutinize the exercise of that power, whatever the circumstances. In other words, the issue was not whether the Court might scrutinize, but how and what the outcome of that scrutiny would be. While in most matters the standard of review would be rationality, a higher form of scrutiny was required in cases involving the executive and in respect of decisions that impacted upon the rights in the Bill of Rights. The Constitution did not oblige the President to appoint a commission of inquiry whenever there were indications of corruption, malfeasance, and misfeasance in relation to public procurement. Where government corruption was indicated, the President was required to take reasonable steps to deal with the matter, and a judicial commission of inquiry was one of the tools in his arsenal. Thus, the Court had to consider whether a decision not to appoint a commission of inquiry constituted a reasonable step in the light of the nature of the corruption indicated and the other steps taken or available, where the nature of the corruption would be well suited to consideration by a commission of inquiry, and no adequate other steps were taken or were reasonably possible, the failure to appoint a commission of inquiry might be regarded as unreasonable and irrational. The question was ultimately whether the government had provided effective mechanisms for dealing with corruption. A commission of inquiry into corruption-related issues would be constitutionally required when no other investigative body was able or likely to conduct the necessary inquiries, or when a degree of independence was required because of the subject matter. In these situations, the court should declare the President's decision not to appoint such a judicial commission of inquiry as unconstitutional. Indications of corruption, malfeasance, and misfeasance in relation to public procurement oblige the appointment of a commission of inquiry when a failure to do so in the particular circumstances would not be reasonable or rational. Any attempt to prevent a full and proper inquiry into the arms deal could never be reasonable or rational. Given this, the heads of argument suggested the President was constitutionally obliged to appoint a commission of inquiry. President Motlanthe's decision in December 2008 not to appoint a judicial commission of inquiry, and rather to rely on ordinary law enforcement when he knew the Scorpions were to be disbanded, which he personally authorized a few weeks later, was clearly not reasonable in the circumstances. In the light of clear inactivity by any other competent or independent body, the continued failure by Presidents Motlanthe and Zuma to appoint a commission of inquiry, as requested, was also unreasonable. Given the vital importance of these issues, the heads of argument stated, the court should issue a declarator confirming that the decisions are unconstitutional and declaring that the President is constitutionally obliged to appoint an independent judicial commission of inquiry as the only independent and effective, and hence the only reasonable and rational, means of getting to the bottom of the allegations of corruption surrounding the arms deal. The court need not resolve any disputes of fact before ordering the appointment of a commission of inquiry. All disputes of fact could be dealt with by the commission itself. The court could only determine whether oral evidence had to be led and how this should be done once the President had filed full affidavits and the applicant had replied. The heads of argument for the Institute for Race Relations concluded, "We submit that it is not appropriate for the President to state that if he were to respond to the factual allegations, disputes of fact would arise. Rather, the President should respond on affidavit, and then this court will be the proper arbiter of whether bona fide disputes of fact have arisen and how they should be dealt with. It is not for the President to second-guess such a consideration by this court."